My guest in the studio graduated from the Brisbane Conservatorium of Music in 1990. A year later, he received a James Morrison scholarship. He went on to tour with James Morrison's band and study in New York City with Wynton Marsalis. Since 2002, he's been based in Hong Kong and has performed with a vast array of artists from Cleo Lane to cantopop megastar Jackie Chung. He's about to officially launch his third album as leader, Sound Barrier, at The Basement. He's now based in Sydney. Blaine Whittaker, welcome to Now's the Time.
Hi, Frank. Great to be here.
Tell us about your family heritage, Blaine. Do you come from a musical background?
As a matter of fact, I do. My dad's a drummer, and he's still playing. He lives up the coast, on the Gold Coast, actually, and he's got a regular Saturday night gig. And I don't know anyone who has a regular Saturday anymore.
Especially on the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
Now, where does he play every week on the Gold Coast?
Oh, it's a great little venue. Funny enough, they call it The Basement. I mean, I think they could have been a bit more original. But it's called The Basement, and it's at the Queensland Performing Arts Complex at the Gold Coast. Gold Coast Arts Centre. And he's the resident trio down there, and they have guests that pop in, and I've done a couple of spots down there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's always fun playing with Dad.
So what sort of music was he exposing you to as a child?
Basically, big band jazz, Stan Getz, people like, you know, Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond. That's where he was coming from. Mm. But I was a clarinet player when I was, you know, younger, so it was all Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, all those great guys.
You grew up in Brisbane?
Well, you know what? I grew up in Sydney.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we moved around.
Right.
I grew up in Sydney. I was born in Sydney, Crown Street Women's Hospital, like everyone else almost around here. So I started out in the Hawkesbury District Concert Band. We lived out near Currajong. It was very rural, very nice. Then we moved up to Byron Bay or Ballina around there. So I finished high school up there. They had a great big band at the school. So that's when I first started playing saxophone in the school band. So from there, I just went 2 hours north to Brisbane when I finished school. And so then I ended up at the Brisbane Con. So then I came back to Sydney, you know. But people still think I'm a Queenslander, you know.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
But I was actually, you know, a New South Welshman.
From the start.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
But it's good to, in a way, it was interesting to have come from somewhere, you know. Oh, where's he from? He's from Brisbane. Oh, great. You know, I guess it's a little bit more interesting to some people. I don't know.
And a lot of the musicians, too, they tend to gravitate towards Melbourne rather than Sydney?
Yes. There's a great pianist from Melbourne called Sam Keevers. Played with Vince Jones for all those years. Well, he's not from Melbourne. He was at the Con with me in Brisbane, see? But everyone thinks he's from Melbourne. But, yeah, so he went straight to Melbourne.
Your latest album, though, Sound Barrier, it moves away from the straight-ahead jazz or the hard bop sound that we've previously identifying you with.
Yeah.
Is this a move purely commercial on your behalf, or is R&B the groove genre something you want to explore further?
The reason I've sort of done a recording like this, I'm pretty sure it was because I was in Hong Kong for all those years. Now, Hong Kong's a pretty commercial city, so the music's going to reflect that. There are other styles of jazz played there, but a lot of the stuff that I was doing was more in this vein. And I actually relished the change in style because playing the sort of music I was in Sydney, which I loved, it was a pleasant change to be suddenly thrown a completely new repertoire of stuff like Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye tunes and obscure things that these people wrote. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much stuff that we don't play here in Sydney as jazz players. There's a lot of musical genres and styles that when you're a jazz bebop player, you don't get involved in Sydney.
They just get ignored.
Well, they're not in the repertoire. So when you're in a place like that overseas, where it's like, no, we're doing this here, I was thrown in the deep end. I had to learn all these new tunes in order to play as a professional over there. And it was great fun. Oh, mate, so much great music.
What was your motivation to move to Hong Kong?
Well, I chased a girl over there. I got married and she got a job there teaching at one of the high schools. And I said, well, let's do it. Let's go. Let's, you know, find some new territory to get involved in. So we went to Hong Kong.
Plenty of opportunity, yeah. Right on China's doorstep.
Yep. And in fact, it's such a burgeoning scene over there. I was flat out playing every night of the week.
Well, I wanted to touch on your experiences in Asia a little bit later. What have you learnt from your musical heroes? I tend to ask this question and I say, who are your musical heroes? I guess your style of music, people are going to know that, you know, Charlie Parker's up there and the Coltrane's, the great saxophonists.
Yeah.
But what have you learnt from these people?
I can tell you what I learnt from these guys. And when they give interviews, you pick up stuff you wouldn't normally pick up through their playing. And one of the common themes that comes out when you listen to some of these guys chatting, and it's obvious in their playing, is they've always searched for their own voice and promoted that and put it out there. And obviously they come from beginnings. You can hear Coltrane play in the early days, and it was very Dexter Gordon. And ultimately he became, you know...
Coltrane.
What we know today as John Coltrane. And even Charlie Parker, you know, he had to start somewhere. They were getting into Lester Young and people like that. But ultimately they forged their own sound and their own voice. If there's anything I've got from my heroes, it's that. And I found myself, I had to tear myself away from listening to Charlie Parker. And when I had that great lesson with Wynton Marsalis, he said that. He said, you know, basically, okay, you sound very much like Charlie Parker. And I said, well, I love that whole bebop, hard bop sound. He said, well, you got to start playing different things. And that was great advice. Like I said, it was hard to stop listening to those great players.
Different things, different repertoire, different licks, different feel.
Mm-hmm.
Was he specific?
Yeah, he was. He said, stop playing bebop phrases. He said, just play melodies. Just play melodies. And he also told me to go right back to Sidney B. Shea, like saxophone players from that era. He said, and a lot of people will actually contend that and say, oh, that's rubbish. Don't do that. And I can appreciate that point of view too, because it was kind of hard going back a little bit. He says things like, we go forward to Duke Ellington and we go forward to Louis Armstrong. You know, all that sort of talk he does.
Yes, yes.
A lot of people hate all that, you know. But I think there's a lot of, there's good stuff there. But I love big bands as well. So if he's doing something with a big band, even if it is all those old charts, I'm still going to dig it. I'm still going to be there and check it out. I particularly liked his septet stuff because I was really entrenched in all that when he was doing that. The seven-piece band, they did all those recordings. And there was like great, because I loved the arrangements and I was so into like four-piece harmony. I used to love the four horns. And I wrote some of that stuff on a previous album. And in fact, it got reviewed by Martin Jackson in Melbourne. And he said, it's a great album, but it's a bit Wynton Marsalis-ish. And I thought that was the best compliment I'd ever had, you know, because I was so into it, you know. But and I saw that band at the Opera House and there was a lot of freedom in there too to be... It was open to all possibilities. Mm. So, and I love that. I find in his big band it's not. It's not open to all possibilities.
Yes.
The soloing is short and it's a bit nostalgic.
As a musician and improviser, how do you measure the success of your craft?
You know what? It's an internal feeling for me. If I'm doing a solo, I can finish the solo and feel terrible because I haven't achieved what I set out to within the realms of that solo. It could be 32 bars. It could be a 10-minute solo. And it's a funny thing. It's like it's so introspective. Yeah, and you can feel kind of, you know, a bit peeved about what you've presented as your art. Yet someone can come up to you and says, oh, man, that was a great solo. It really lifted me. And so you can be mistaken, but for me, it's an internal feeling.
Well, I can relate to what you're saying there. I was reading an interview with Joe Lovano and Dave Liebman and Michael Brecker, and I can't remember which one of them now, but one of them actually referred to a situation where they went backstage and to congratulate Coltrane after a set, you know.
Right.
And, of course, Coltrane said, well, you know, it's not as good as how I played in the kitchen yesterday, you know. Yeah. And it was really glum because it was...
Yeah.
Was so, and yet it was just a mind-blowing set. So it's jazz is funny, isn't it? It's I think that's the good thing about jazz. Everything is up for personal interpretation because it is a personal expression. It is true art.
Yeah, it is. In the moment that you're playing it, that's the art. And I think if you're honest when you're doing that solo, if you're honestly playing what you're feeling and hearing... That's job well done, I think.
Richard McGrath told me the same thing a few weeks ago, bringing that honesty factor into it.
Yeah, right. In that way, you're articulating your own voice, which I'm getting back to. That's the most important thing, to articulate what you're hearing and sensing through that instrument. That's the true art of improvising, you know?
You play alto and baritone. Do you play tenor?
I played it last night on a gig, actually.
Did you?
Yeah, I don't... I don't record on it. Like, I would never do a jazz album on tenor. It's not my voice, really. Mm. But if someone says, hey, bring the tenor, I'll bring it.
And you're the best judge?
Yeah, I'm not, because I'm very self-critical. Some people say, man, you play great tenor. You should play it more. But I'd rather not.
If you weren't a saxophonist then, what profession do you think you would have been drawn to?
I often think about that. Yeah, I often think, gee, what the hell would I have done if I didn't... When I was at the conservatorium, I used to think that I was going to go to the Real Estate Institute and learn real estate, you know.
What a contrast.
Yeah, because I'm still...
You're still trying to sell something.
I'm on the radio selling something now. And my uncle was a real estate developer, and my dad sold real estate, even though he played drums.
Well, my father was a real estate agent too, and the size of his record collection is just enormous.
Yeah, and this uncle of mine that was big into development played the saxophone. So it was sort of like, well, yeah, I'll do that, because I was attracted to him as a guy. He had a bit of bread back then. He went broke after in the bad old days. But, you know, I thought, well, yeah, play saxophone and get into real estate. And then I met James Morrison in Brisbane, and he sort of made me hip to the possibility of being full-time musician. And so there I am, you know.
Well, we touched on it earlier, but what is the scene like in China? You've been based in Hong Kong for those years. You've been able to do the tours into China.
Yeah. Well, China's changing. For 50 years there, jazz was illegal. You weren't allowed to play jazz. And so now you can, and there's jazz clubs all over Shanghai. And young players are learning this style of music. It's great. It's really opening up, and it's a real burgeoning scene. Hong Kong's great, but that's always been good. But the whole China thing... It's fascinating.
Money's always invariably a touchy subject for musos, and I'd imagine even more so when you're dealing with promoters and club owners, especially in Asia. But have you ever had any bizarre or overly difficult experiences in getting remunerated as a
artist? There or
well,
here?
Anywhere.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I've been not paid for gigs in the past. And back when we had a musicians' union, which had some, you know, strength, not that I'm a huge unionist or anything, but I was a member. And I didn't get paid by a couple of guys, and I took them to court, and the union got me the money. But it was terrible, you know. They were saying awful things, you know. And that happened. I was owed about $1,000 from one bloke. I just moved to Sydney. I was a bit green to certain things, and I did 10 shows for $90 each.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah, and these shows, it went on. It was one a week. Hmm. It went on for 2 months or so, you know. And at the end of it, there was no check. And he kept fobbing us off, oh, the money will be here next week. So suddenly it was up to like $990. And I had to take him to the union, and I got the money.
Well, good on you.
You know? So it worked. So the union's good.
Miles Davis, often quoted as telling his sidemen to play what they don't know rather than what they know. Now, how difficult is walking that fine line and still trying to be accessible to your audience?
It just depends who your audience is, because your audience may be craving that sort of thing. And they're like, great. You know, he's sort of getting into territory that... not even he's familiar with. So that audience is going to love that, you know.
Do you find yourself trying to do that, or do you move away from... do you keep yourself, your creativity corralled? How do you handle that situation?
I like the idea of having some sort of parameters within a medium that I'm... in other words, I'm not going to get out there and do an experimental piece at the basement on the 20th, because that's not what I'm doing at the moment. And I'm not going to do a bebop number either, because I'm not doing that either. So there's sort of parameters within the scope that I'm happy to work within for a night or for a period of time even. Obviously, this album is a new sound for me, and I'm investigating all of that. Some people hate the DJ thing. I was looking for a different sound. Some people are too conservative to have a DJ on there. When it was suggested to me to do that, because I was looking for a new sound to cover those sections in that song, and I just didn't want to have another instrument. I wanted a certain sound. And so I opted for that, and I think it worked out, you know. Because some people think, oh, this sort of style of music can be sort of set and maybe stilted and not open to all possibilities. And that's just simply not true. So the creative element is very much there in the forefront. And, you know, when we play a melody with me and the guitarist playing unison, to my mind, that's coming straight out of the bebop era where horns played melodies in unison. And that's how I'm approaching all that.
Yes.
It's still very much focused on instrumentation and solos and that whole thing of, okay, let's hear the guitarist play.
Blaine, what's on the horizon for you?
I'm going to try and, you know, do some gigs with this album and this sort of format. That'll probably go on for the next, you know, 12 months, 18 months. I'll probably start writing again when I feel like it, which hopefully will be sooner than later. I just don't feel like it right now, you know. With this launch and other stuff, it's you got to really feel like writing to start writing, you know.
Does it come easy to you once you feel like it?
Yeah, it does. It's a certain mood that takes you and you start fiddling at the piano. Right now, I'm into practicing and I haven't been so enthusiastic about practice for ages. So I'm really into practicing. I'm practicing every day, which is I'm finding really good fun.
There must be always something to learn. There's always something new to learn.
Yeah, what happens is you're sort of playing by yourself and then you'll stumble across a certain relationship that notes you're playing have with one another, and you'll start to enjoy that relationship with those notes. So suddenly you're playing something very new. Obviously, you've never played it before, you know, and that's exciting when you're practicing. It's moments like that that you really try and you really start growing as a player when you get to those bits, you know.
Blaine Whittaker, thanks very much for joining me in the studio tonight.
Thanks, Frank.